The Informer. The old man stood beside him now, and passing his staff over into his left hand, laid the right on Joseph's head, and gazed with penetrating old eyes into the youth's lovely black ones, who first looked up at him, his lips parting in a smile that showed again the gleaming enamel of his separated teeth, then dropped his eyes, partly in simple reverence, but also from a flickering sense of guilt that rose from his father's command to cover himself. Truly it was not alone the pleasant coolness of the evening air that had made him slow to resume his garment, and he suspected his father of reading his mind and the impulses that had led to his addressing his half-nude observances to the moon. It was true that he had found it sweet and of good omen to display his young body to her, with whom he felt himself connected through his horoscope and by all sorts of intuitions and imaginings, convinced that she must take pleasure in it, and of set purpose to charm her or the powers above in general and prejudice them in his favor. The sensation of cool brightness that touched his shoulders with the evening air had confirmed to him the success of his childish enterprise, which we must not consider shameless, because it was really tantamount to a sacrifice of shame. We must remember that the rite of circumcision, taken over as outward practice from the Egyptians, had in Joseph's family and tribe long ago acquired a peculiar mystic significance. It was the marriage, commanded and appointed by God, between man and the deity, performed upon that part of the flesh which seemed to form the focus of his being, and upon which every physical vow was taken. Many a man bore the name of God on his organ of generation, or wrote it there before he possessed a woman. The bond of faith with God was sexual in its nature, and thus, contracted with a jealous Creator and Lord, insistent upon sole possession, it inflicted upon the human male a kind of civilizing weakening into the female. The bloody sacrifice of circumcision has more than a physical connection with emasculation. The sanctifying of the flesh signified both being made chaste and the offering up of chastity as a sacrifice. In other words, a female significance. Joseph, moreover, as he knew himself and as everybody told him, was both beautiful and well-favored, a condition which certainly embraces a consciousness of femininity. And beautiful was an adjective always and by everybody used to describe the moon. In particular, the full, unshrouded, and unclouded moon, a moon word, in short, belonging by right to the heavenly sphere, and only applicable by transference among men, so that in Joseph's mind the idea beautiful and the idea nude flowed together and were interchangeable almost at will, and it seemed to him the part both of wisdom and piety to respond to the unshrouded loveliness of the planet with his own, that the pleasure and admiration might be mutual. How much connection there was between these vague sentiments and a certain degeneracy betrayed in his behavior, I should not like to say. At all events, the sentiments had their origin in the primitive meaning of a ritual uncovering, which was still customary and often practiced before his eyes. Just for that very reason, it was that he felt a vague sense of shame in his father's presence and correction, for he both loved and feared the old man's spiritual side, and was aware that he repudiated as sinful a good share of the thought world to which Joseph clung, if only in fancy and child's play. Putting it behind him as pre-Abramite, applying to it his swiftest and most frightful condemnation, the word idolatrous. The youth prepared himself for an express and downright admonition in this sense. But Jacob, from among the cares that as always weighed him down in connection with this son of his, produced a different one. He began, "Verily, it had been better did my child sleep now after his devotions in the shelter of the house. Unwillingly I behold him alone in the oncoming night, beneath the stars which shine alike upon the good and the evil doer. Why has he not kept with the sons of Leah, or gone whither the sons of Bilhah went?" He was well aware why Joseph once again had not gone with them, and Joseph knew that only Jacob's distress over the long-standing situation could have driven him to the question. He answered, with his lips stuck out, "My brethren and I discussed the matter, and resolved it in peace." Jacob went on, "It may come about that the lion of the desert, and he who had his dwelling in the canebrake of the outlet where it flows into the salt sea, comes when he is hungry and falls upon the flocks, when he thirst after blood and seek his prey. It is 5 days since Almodad the shepherd lay before me on his belly and confessed that a ravening beast had struck down 2 ewes in the night and dragged one away to devour it. Almodad was pure in my sight without an oath, for he showed to me the one ewe in her blood, so that it was plain to the understanding that the lion had stolen the other, and so the loss came upon my own head." "It is little loss," said Joseph wheedlingly. "Verily, it is as nothing compared with the riches the Lord hath vouchsafed out of his love to my lord in Mesopotamia." Jacob bowed his head, letting it droop a little toward the right shoulder, in token that he did not vaunt himself over the blessing. Though even so, it had scarcely been effective without some shrewd assistance on his own part. He answered, "To whom much is given, from him can much be taken away. The Lord hath made me silver, yet can he make me clay and poor as the potsherds on the dung heap. For his spirit is mighty, and we know not the ways of his righteousness. Silver hath a pale light," he went on, keeping his eyes away from the moon, to which Joseph straightway sent up a sideways glance. "Silver is affliction, and the bitterest fear of the fearful is the folly of those for whom his heart is heavy." The boy looked entreatingly at him, and made a caressing and soothing gesture. Jacob did not let him finish. He went on, "It was where the shepherds keep their flocks, 100 or 200 paces from here, that the lion crept up and stole the ewe lambs away from their dam. But my child sits alone by the well at night, naked and without a weapon, careless and forgetful of the father heart. Art thou made for danger, and armed for strife? Art thou like Simeon and Levi, thy brothers, may God keep them, who fall upon the enemy with clamor, sword in hand, and who burned the city of the Amorites? Or art thou like Esau, thy uncle, at Seir, in the deserts of the south, a hunter and man of the field, red of skin and hairy like a he-goat? No, thou art gentle and a dweller in tents, for thou art flesh of my flesh. And when Esau came to the ford with 400 men, and my soul knew not the issue before the Lord, I put the handmaids and their children, thy brothers, foremost, and Leah with her children after. And lo, thee I put hindermost with Rachel thy mother." His eyes had already filled with tears. He could not name dry-eyed the name of her whom he had loved beyond all else, although it was 8 years since God had so incomprehensibly taken her from him. His voice, always full of feeling, faltered and broke. The boy stretched out his arms to his father, then carried the clasped hands to his lips. "How idly troubleth itself," he said in tender reproach, "the heart of my father and dear Lord, and how extravagant is his concern! When our guest wished us good health, and went to see after his precious image," he smiled maliciously to please Jacob, and added, "which seemed to me poor and impotent indeed, and worthless as coarse earthenware in the market." "Thou sawest it?" broke in Jacob. Even this vexed and misgave him. "I besought the guest to show it me before the evening meal," answered Joseph, curling his lip and shrugging his shoulder. "It is mediocre work, and feebleness stands written on its brow. As the talk between thee and thy guest came to an end, I went out with my brothers. but one of Leah's maid's sons, I think it was Gad, whose manner is blunt and downright, told me not to set my feet in his steps nor the steps of the others, and somewhat bruised me in my soul, for he called me not by my name, but with false and evil ones, to which I do not listen gladly. He had launched into his tale without thinking, and against his own will, for he was aware of a certain tendency in himself. It detracted from his own self-satisfaction, and he honorably desired to conquer it, in fact, had already struggled with it the moment before. He could never check his need to communicate his thoughts, and it here operated in a vicious circle with the bad relations to his brethren. By estranging him from them, and thus driving him closer to his father, there was created for him an immediate position which lent itself easily to tale-bearing, and the tale-bearing, in its turn, increased the estrangement, and so on, so that one could not say with whom the wrong had begun, and at least the oldest ones among his brothers could hardly catch sight of Rachel's son without making a face. But the original source was no doubt Jacob's love for this son of his, an actual fact with which one would not wish to reproach the too much feeling man. Feeling, however, of its own nature, inclines to unrestraint, and an enervating cult of itself. It will not be hidden. It knows no reserves. It behaves so as to draw attention upon itself. It flies in the face of the world, that the world may be driven to take notice. Such is the intemperance of the feelingful, and Jacob was encouraged in his by the tradition handed down in his tribe of God's own intemperateness and majestic caprice in matters of sympathy and preference. El Elyon's way of preferring this and that one, without, or at least over and above, merit on their part, was very high-handed, hard to understand, and, humanly speaking, often unjust. It was a fixed and lofty state of feeling which was not to be interpreted, but simply to be honored with fear and ecstasy in the dust. And Jacob, himself a conscious, if also a humble and fearful object of one among these predilections, imitated his God in that he wantonly insisted upon his own, and gave them free rein. The soft unrestraint of the man of feeling was Joseph's heritage from his father. Later I shall have to tell of his powerlessness to set limits to his fullness, or the lack of tact which brought him into extreme danger. At 9 years old, still quite a child, it had been he who complained to his father of Reuben, a good if impetuous youth, who, seeing that Jacob, after Rachel's death, had made his bed with Bilhah the maid, and taken her for his favorite, while Leah crouched neglected and red-eyed in her tent, had torn his father's cot from the new place and mishandled it with curses. It was a rash act, committed out of offended filial pride, committed for Leah's sake, and early rude. The bed might have been quietly set up again. Jacob needed to hear naught of the occurrence. But Joseph had seen, and had nothing better to do than to tell the father. And it was since that time that Jacob, himself the firstborn, not in the way of nature, but only nominally and legally, conceived the plan of divesting Reuben of his right, depriving him of the blessing, to confer it not on Simeon, Leah's second, the next in order, but with the most arbitrary exercise of authority, on Joseph. His brethren did the youth wrong in saying that his prattle was deliberately directing the parental resolve toward such a goal. It was the simple truth that he could not keep still. But that he could not hold his tongue, even after he knew of the plan and his brother's accusation, was harder to forgive, and was like fuel to the flames of their suspicion. It is not generally known how Reuben's sporting with Bilhah came to Jacob's ears. That was a much worse affair than the one with the bed. It had happened before they settled at Hebron, at a place between Hebron and Bethel. Reuben, then 21, in the full tide of his strength and instincts, had not been able to refrain from his father's wife, the very same Bilhah toward whom he cherished so bitter a grudge, because she had dispossessed Leah, his mother. He had spied upon her in the bath, first by chance, then for the pleasure of humiliating her without her knowledge, until desire took the upper hand. A rash and sensual passion for Bilhah's mature and artfully preserved charms for her still firm breasts and soft belly had seized on the hardy youth, and was not to be stilled by any of the maids, any yielding and submissive Shechemite slave. He slipped in to his father's concubine and present favorite. He took her unawares, and if he did her no violence, yet the woman, who before Jacob did but tremble, was seduced by the overmastering pride of his youthful virility. Joseph, lounging idly about the camp, if not precisely with intent to spy, had learned enough of this scene of passion to make simple and zealous report to the father that Reuben had sported and laughed with Bilhah. The words conveyed less than he really knew, yet in the local parlance they insinuated everything. Jacob turned pale and gasped. Not many minutes after the boy had told all his tale, Bilhah lay whimpering before the master, tearing with her nails those breasts which Reuben had thrown in confusion. Now forever bespotted and untouchable by her lawful lord. The evil-doer lay there too, girt only in sackcloth, in token of his abasement and surrender, with his hands lifted above his disheveled and dust-strewn head, in utter abandonment, letting pass over him the formal fury of his father's wrath. Jacob called him Ham, the shamer of his sire, the dragon of the prime, Behemoth, and shameless hippopotamus, the last with reference to an Egyptian legend that this animal has the devastating habit of killing its father and mating with its mother by violence. That was to assume that Bilhah, because he himself slept with her, was really Reuben's mother. In his words of thunder rumbled the sinister old idea that Reuben, by lying with his mother, had betrayed his wish to be lord over all, and Jacob met the assumption by making him lord over nothing. He stretched forth his arm and took away from the groaning sinner his firstborn rights, took them indeed only unto himself, without for the moment bestowing the title further, so that from then on the matter was undecided, save as the majestic partiality of the father's heart took the place, for the time being, of legal fact. It was remarkable that Reuben bore the boy Joseph no grudge, but of all the brothers behaved most forbearingly towards him. Justly enough, he did not attribute the boy's behavior to pure malice, but in his heart gave him right for cherishing the honor of so loving a father and making known to him events the shocking character of which Reuben was far from denying. Conscious of his own frailty, Reuben was good-natured and just. In his person rather ill-favored, though of great strength like all of Leah's sons, having his mother's stupid eyes with the constitutionally superating lids, on which he spent much ointment to little end, he was more accessible than the others to Joseph's admitted charms, was dumbly moved by them, and could feel it right that that inheritance from the wandering fathers of his race, the blessing and the election, should fall upon the lad, rather than upon him or any other of the 12. However sorely smitten by the parental wishes and designs concerning the blessing of the firstborn, he consented to them with his mind. Joseph had known very well what he was about when he threatened with Reuben's wrath the son of Zilpah, who, moreover, in his downrightness, was by no means the worst of the lot, for Reuben had often, even if contemptuously, stood up for Joseph, often protected him with the strength of his arm, and rebuked the brothers when, enraged at his tattling ways, they were provoked to fall foul of him. For the simpleton learned nothing from the early and serious occurrences with Reuben, made no amendment through the latter's magnanimity, and as he grew up, became a more dangerous eavesdropper and tale-bearer than he had been as a child. Dangerous to himself, too, and in particular, for the role he had taught himself to play daily heightened both his observation and his isolated state, prejudiced his happiness, drew down upon him a hatred which it was not in the power of his nature to bear, and gave him every ground to fear his brothers, the which then supplied fresh temptation to flatter the father and secure himself against them. All this, despite oft-taken resolves to let his tongue refrain from poison, and thus to heal his relations with the 10, of whom none was actually a scoundrel, and with whom he felt a secret and sacred bond on the score of the number of the signs of the zodiac, whose circle he and his little brother helped to complete. In vain. Whenever Simeon and Levi, always swift in anger, had brawled with strange shepherds, or even with people in the town, and brought shame upon the tribe, whenever Judah, a proud and afflicted man, whom Ishtar plagued, so that he found cause for tears, in matters where others found cause for laughing, had become secretly involved with the daughters of the countryside, displeasingly to Jacob, whenever one among the brothers had sinned before the only and most high God by privily burning incense to an idol, thus imperiling the fruitfulness of the flocks, and threatening to bring down pox, or scab, or staggers upon them, or whenever the sons, either at home or at Shechem, had tried to make a little extra profit from the sale of the fallow cattle, and quietly to divide it among themselves, the father heard of it from his favorite child. He even heard things without truth or reason, and was prone to believe them for the sake of Joseph's beautiful eyes. The lad asserted that some of the brothers had repeatedly cut steaks from the flesh of living sheep and rams, and eaten them, and that this had been done by the sons of the two concubines, but to excess by Asher, who was in fact a good deal of a glutton. This appetite of Asher was the only evidence in support of a charge which on its face looked incredible, and which could never have been established against the four. Objectively speaking, it was a slander. From Joseph's point of view, perhaps it did not quite deserve that name. He may have dreamed it, or more precisely, had let himself dream it, at some time when he deserved and was expecting a beating, in order to seek shelter behind it with his father, and afterwards could or would not distinguish between truth and barefaced lie. In this instance, of course, the fury of the brothers found more than usually extravagant vent. They declared their innocence of the charge with such vehemence as almost to render them suspect, as almost to make one think some small grain of truth lay at the bottom of it. We are usually bitterest over accusations which are false, of course, and yet perhaps not utterly without ground, after all.